This is a story of how I happened to be in China in 1989 during the Tiananmen Square incident. This story is a long story, but it's a story about the most life-altering experience that I have ever endured. In 1989, I was teaching at Marietta College, a small liberal arts college in southeastern Ohio. Marietta College had an exchange program with the Southwest University of Finance and Economics, which was in Chengdu, the provincial capital of the Sichuan province in the People's Republic of China. The Southwest University of Finance and Economics, which everyone called SUFEI, would send students and faculty to the U.S., and Marietta College would send students and faculty to China. Students would go for a year to teach English, and Chinese students would come to the U.S. to work in Chinese restaurants and to ultimately seek political asylum in New York City. Faculty would go usually for a semester, and in my case, I was invited to go for the summer. So in late 1988, I received the invitation to go to the People's Republic of China in the spring of 1989 and teach video production at the Southwest University of Finance and Economics at SUFEI. An administrator from the Marietta College campus had visited SUFEI and had determined in some way that still remains a mystery to me that the staff at the media center at SUFEI needed or wanted training in video production. They wanted to learn about lighting and editing and directing and producing, and that's what I taught at Marietta, so that's how I got invited. And I was also invited to take a student with me. So after a rather lengthy process of seeking applicants and screening them and doing interviews, I selected a guy named Bill Carroll to go along as a teaching assistant. Well, in the spring of 1989, there was a pro-democracy movement in China. It was a very unsettled time. There were a lot of protests, there were riots, and it was of a good deal of concern to us as we prepared to leave. I remember asking Frank Cheng, who was the Marietta College expert on China, if he thought that this was going to be an issue in our trip. And he assured me that it would not. He thought that it was a small pro-democracy movement. It was limited to the Beijing area, and it would be easily put down by the government. It would be of no concern to us. So on about Mother's Day in 1989, I think it was either Mother's Day or the day before, we boarded a plane to Chengdu. Well, it was obvious fairly quickly as we started to teach that the pro-democracy movement was going to have an impact in Sichuan. I didn't really realize it at the time. I didn't really know why some of these things were happening, but no students had attended our lectures. In fact, there weren't very many students on this campus, it seemed, and we discovered later that was because they were going into the city, into the central square in Chengdu, to protest. We also, at one time, had a gathering outside our apartment of a bunch of protesters or a bunch of students, and they were carrying banners and chanting, and they were throwing glass bottles, and I remember it was very upsetting to Bill and I. We thought that somehow they were protesting our presence, and we didn't want to stick our noses outside the apartment. We'd kind of peer out through the windows. And at some point, I remember we did open the door and we looked out. And when we did, the crowd cheered. And we were relieved, realized at that point that they weren't firebombing our apartment building. And much later, we discovered that they actually just were seeking our support because this was a pro-democracy movement. They knew that there were Americans staying in this apartment building. We knew that we would support the democracy movement and wanted us to kind of come out and wave and just show some kind of support for them. And the breaking of the bottles was actually a symbolic gesture. China's leader at that time was Deng Xiaoping, and Xiaoping means little bottle. And so by smashing the little bottles, they were symbolically smashing Deng Xiaoping's rule. As time went on, things became increasingly unsettled in Chengdu, and we had lots of time on our hands because no one was attending any of the classes. No one was on campus. They'd march into the city and protest, and then the university trucks would go fetch them back to the campus so they could rest up and get some nourishment and then march back into the city and protest more. And on one occasion, Bill and I went into the city square and we were just absolutely astounded. There were thousands and thousands of people sitting in the streets, sitting on the monument in the middle of the public square, sitting on the steps of all the provincial governmental buildings that surrounded the square. A sea of thousands of Chinese factory workers, students, farmers, all showing support for the pro-democracy movement. Well, within a couple of days, the university decided that it would be a good idea if we left the city. The protesters became increasingly agitated, and they would take off on marches through the streets. And ultimately, one of these marches ended up in rock throwing and fire bombings, and there was a good deal of destruction in the downtown of the city. And so on that day, the university finally decided just Bill and I needed to leave. We needed to be headed back to the coast and get to Shanghai or Beijing. So they took us to the train station, and they put us on a train without a translator. Our interpreter and guide through our ordeal in China had been Mr. Jing Guan. And I recall that Mr. Jing Guan took us to the Chengdu train station. It just sort of gradually dawned on me that he was putting us on the train and wasn't going along. And that alarmed me. Neither Bill nor I spoke Mandarin Chinese, and we thought that we really needed an interpreter. And Mr. Jing Guan said that there was no need to be concerned, that it was a short train ride. It was actually about 12 hours on the train. It was supposed to be 12, maybe 14 hours. And there would be someone to meet us in Shanghai, and they would get us to a hotel and make the arrangements for us to fly back to the U.S., albeit a bit prematurely. So we boarded the train with some hesitation. I was still uncomfortable about just setting off without someone with us, but Jing Guan assured us that the tickets were paid for and we had money, and away we went. And what was supposed to be a 12-hour train ride turned into about a 3-day train ride. The train would stop in the middle of nowhere and sit for hours and hours in the middle of the blazing heat in southwest China, in a sealed-up rail car in which Bill Carroll and I were sharing a compartment with a Chinese couple. So this little room was about 6 feet by 6 feet, and it had four bunk beds in it. And Bill and I slept on one side, and the Chinese couple slept on the other side. And its windows were sealed. And there was no air conditioning in the car. There was supposed to be, but it was malfunctioning. And the temperature in that compartment was just unbelievable. I remember I had the top bunk, and it was like being in an oven and being awakened by the Chinese couple eating hard-boiled eggs, the sort of sound and smell of which was just not good in the heat of that compartment. On occasion, the train would stop, and we would be let off the train to stretch our legs and purchase an orange soda, and of course, not speaking or reading Chinese. Bill and I never knew where we were, so we'd get off this train, you know, maybe a day and a half into this trip that was supposed to be 12 hours long, and just bewildered and had no idea where we were, just somewhere out in the middle of China, and just wanted to make sure that we got back on the train before the train would leave the station. At one point on the ride, I remember that there was a stowaway. A young fellow had gotten onto the train at one of these stops, and the conductors, who were armed, more like military police, brought this guy into the same rail car in which we were riding, and there was a little compartment, which is the conductor's compartment. And I was in the hallway of the rail car as they drug this young guy into this room and interrogated him. And they took all of his stuff. They took his cigarettes and they took his money and they took his clothing and walked to the door of this car, this train car, opened up the door and threw everything out except for the money and the smokes that they wanted to keep. Everything they just threw out along the track, and then off they went with him, and I'm sure locked him up somewhere. And so the trip wore on, and Bill and I had taken a loaf of bread with us, and I think one of us had a bag of peanuts. And occasionally they would come around with warm water with which to make tea. And so for most of 3 days, Bill and I lived on a loaf of French bread and some peanuts and warm water. On another occasion, the conductor came into our compartment, and he started to request, or in fact demand from us, something that we didn't understand. He became very agitated and was asking for something I had no idea what. And finally, frustrated, he left and eventually came back with a young Chinese woman who spoke English and turned out was a medical student who was returning to Shanghai to further her studies. And he spoke to her at length, and she turned to me and said, "He says you owe him money." And I said, "No, I don't owe him any money." And immediately what flashed into my head was that he thought that since we were Americans, we probably had a lot of money, and since he was armed and represented authority, that we would hand it over. And I was getting a little testy by this point because I'd been on this miserable train for quite some time and was increasingly concerned that we were ever going to get to Shanghai. So I was belligerent enough to say, "No, I don't owe you any money." And I instructed this young woman to tell him that, no, I did not owe him any money. And this seemed to not make him any happier. In fact, he became more agitated and raised his voice and was screaming away at this young woman, and she turns around and says, "No, he insists that you owe him money." And I said, "No, I don't owe him any money. I've got a ticket. My ticket's been paid for. I have got my passport, my visa." I started showing all these documents, which I'd already shown him once, and I'm emptying all these things out of my pockets. Here's my ticket, here's my passport, and somehow I'd omitted, and on this next purging of my pockets, I brought out this document that we called a white card. And the white card was something like a visa. Basically, the white card identified us as guests of the government because we were teaching. So we were technically guests of the Chinese government providing a service. And when that document came out, he went, and was, very apologetic and very humble. And it turned out that he really did think we had paid too little for our tickets. The tickets that we were carrying were tickets that would be sold to a Chinese national. And those were cheap tickets. And we, being foreigners, should have had expensive tickets, the expensive tourist foreigner ticket. And so when I presented my ticket, he really did think that I had not paid enough money for my ticket. So with that cleared up, the trip continued. And I remember 2.5 days into this trip, actually starting to think to myself that we had died, that the train had in fact plummeted into some ravine, and that I was dead and I was in hell. And this was my hell, that I would be in this rail car, sealed up, with the windows bolted shut as they were, with no air conditioning, with Bill Carroll and this Chinese couple through eternity, and would never reach Shanghai. I would just sort of be moving aimlessly across the Chinese countryside, never sure of where I was. we would see these trains occasionally and became aware of why our trip had been extended. Troops were being moved all across China in response to the pro-democracy movement. So we would meet trains that were carrying tanks and trucks and trains just full of troops. And the Chinese people, sympathetic to the pro-democracy movement, were interfering with the train travel. So they would blow up a bridge, they would tear up some tracks, throw things on the tracks, and just generally do things to disrupt rail service. So we would have to stop while these things were repaired, or we found a way to be diverted around them or whatever. And it just took forever to get completely across China. And finally, we realized that we were about to reach Shanghai. And I don't know how we knew this now, but we were nearing Shanghai, and I think we could see it off in the distance. And again, the train stopped. So close, but yet just too far to walk. And we sat and we sat and finally began to creep ever so slowly into the Shanghai rail station. And afterward discovered what had happened. The train in front of ours had been carrying troops. They were being brought to Shanghai to deal with some of the unrest. And the protesters tried to stop the train by laying down on the tracks. So the train ran over the protesters. And this then ignited the rest of the protesters, who ignited the train. So the train was burning on the tracks, and it took a while to extinguish that and then to clear the debris. And once that was done, then our train started to creep into the station. After roughly 3 days on this train, living on a loaf of French bread and a little bag of peanuts and some occasional warm water, we finally arrive at Shanghai, and we drag all of our bags through the station, finally emerge onto the street where there are just literally thousands of people, and we hesitate for a moment, and a crowd instantly gathers around us because we're the biggest, tallest, whitest Americans on the street at that very moment, and quite a curiosity, partly because martial law had been declared and we didn't know that. I get this sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach that I'm in the most populous city in the world. I don't speak the language, I have no clue where I am, and I'm not really sure how to get out of this city. For an instant, I was pretty bummed out. I remembered reading in a Fodor's travel book that there was a Hilton Hotel in Shanghai. So I wrote on a little scrap of paper, Hilton. And I began to hold that piece of paper out and move through this crowd of people that had instantly gathered around us. And finally, some guy in the crowd looked at the piece of paper and went, "Ah, Hilton." I got this guy aside and I said, "This, I want to go here. We need to go to the Hilton. Can you get me a taxi to the Hilton?" And he did, hail a taxi. Told the driver that we wanted to go to the Hilton Hotel. We loaded all of our bags and belongings into the back of the cab, climbed inside the taxi, and the driver told us what the fare would be to take us to the Hilton Hotel. And I prepared to pay him in people's currency, what's called renminbi. And I started to count out the correct amount of renminbi to pay for our trip, and he said, no, FEC, and FEC meant foreign exchange currency, which was the currency that tourists and visitors to China would carry, cash in their traveler's checks and get this foreign exchange currency. So it had value. The renminbi, on the other hand, had no value. It was the Chinese currency that the Chinese people carried, not backed by gold and worthless outside of China at that time. So I prepare to stick the renminbi back in my pocket and give him the right amount of FEC, and all of a sudden Bill says, "Oh, no, we're not paying an FEC." I don't remember, I think I might have had to knock him unconscious. But we paid the fare, and we started through the streets of Shanghai. And again, I had a sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach. I started thinking about Shanghai, and I started thinking about what all that meant, about being abducted and taken through the streets and alleys of a far-off city, robbed of your money, and dumped into a harbor. And I wondered if we would ever get to the Hilton Hotel. And when we did pull up in front of the Hilton Hotel, and we climbed out of the taxi, and the Hilton staff came out dressed immaculately, helping with our bags, welcoming us, I teared up and cried like a baby. I had never been so happy to be anywhere in my life. We took a room on the 17th floor of the Hilton Hotel and commenced to figure out what our next move would be. Again, by that time, martial law had been declared, and technically we were not supposed to be out on the streets, although we did go out on the streets and roamed around parts of the city of Shanghai. And we saw plenty of rioting, some burned out buses, other signs of unrest that were taking place in the city. And by now I was also pretty pissy because Marietta College, I felt, had dropped the ball. They'd sent us off to a civil war, and we were probably at some risk at various points in this trip, and they really had no idea where we were. When we got back to the U.S. and I saw the front page of some of the local papers, there were these little snapshot pictures of Bill Carroll and I and a story indicating that we were sort of lost in China and no one exactly knew our whereabouts and they had been unable to keep in contact with us. And of course, that was essentially true. Really, communication was such at the time that we had no way to communicate with Marietta College, even from the Hilton Hotel in Shanghai. But I was convinced that they were going to pick up the tab for whatever we did as long as we were stuck there. And so each night we would go to the 30th floor of the Hilton where there was a restaurant and a lounge, and we would have really good steaks and listen to the band and drank good scotch and tipped handsomely. Well, one night we came back from the 30th floor lounge and a letter had been slid under the door of our room, and it was a letter from the U.S. Consulate General. And the letter advised us to leave the country immediately. It said something to the effect that they had tracked down all Americans, and the city was considered no longer safe, and because of martial law, we were advised to get out of the city immediately. And if we could not make arrangements on our own, they would arrange to have us taken out on a military transport to Tokyo, and from Tokyo, we could make arrangements on a commercial airline to get back to the U.S. We had round-trip tickets on Northwest Airlines. I set about the task of trying to figure out if Northwest was still flying into the country, and if so, how could we get on one of the airplanes? So I went to the concierge at the Hilton Hotel, and I explained the situation, and he said, "Give me your tickets, and I'll see what I can do." And that made me uneasy. But having no real alternative, I gave him our tickets. And late that evening, he returned with boarding passes. And he explained to us that because of martial law, that we were not permitted to be out on the street. So the plan was we would get up in the wee hours and get into the hotel van and immediately head out of the city and take the ring road around the city so as not to be stopped by any of the military police, and to get to the airport before dawn so we wouldn't be seen on our way out. And we did this. And we got to the airport, and it was a scene of utter chaos. Thousands of people trying to get out of the country. Almost all of them Chinese, some from Hong Kong, some who were from the People's Republic of China and just trying to get out. No one was really sure what was going to happen with the declaration of martial law and the escalating tensions between the pro-democracy protesters and the government. Things were pretty unstable. The flight crew from the Northwest Airlines flight actually did the boarding. They came into the terminal and came to the gate, and they were doing the ticketing and the seat assignments. And, of course, Bill Carroll and I, standing about a head and shoulders taller than everyone else in the crowd, they spotted us and actually called us up to the front of the line and got our seat assignments, and we got on the aircraft. And the aircraft was absolutely packed. Every seat was full. And when the plane lifted off the runway, everyone on the aircraft erupted into spontaneous applause and cheering because they were so relieved to be getting out of the country as things continued to deteriorate. Well, it really wasn't until we were back in the U.S. that we learned about the Tiananmen Square incident and the confrontations between the protesters and the Chinese army, because there'd been a complete news blackout in China. The only news that was traveling was what was coming in from sources like Voice of America and Radio Moscow, and Chinese dissidents would listen to these broadcasts, and then they would make posters, which they would post on what was called the Democracy Wall. And unfortunately, we could not read Chinese, and occasionally someone would tell us a bit of what was happening. But most of the time, Bill and I were blissfully ignorant of the severity of the situation that we had just come through. And that's how I happened to be in China in 1989 at the time of the Tiananmen Square incident.